One of our youth staff members sent me a Q&A to listen to from a conference on church singing, and listening to these folks talk about leading music in church, it just reminded me again what a unique privilege it is to take truth, combine it with the gift of music, and then share in that corporately. So thank you to those that have prepared to lead us in that, and thank you to you guys for singing out. There's great hope for a church with audible corporate singing. That means God is at work. So praise God for that. This morning we have the privilege to continue in the book of Exodus. And I'm going to give you a temporary reprieve from our usual stand and read this morning, simply because the text is so long, I fear lest any of you grow faint along the way. But we are going to try to dive into the rest of the chapter 2 of Exodus, as we continue looking at the life of Moses. You can see our message this morning is called A Grief Observed, which I absolutely stole from the title of a C.S. Lewis book, in which he worked through a grief, a loss of his wife and his own life, and a really remarkable book I commend to you if you want to see somebody just in an incredibly honest way work through true suffering. But I'm stealing the words, but not the same meaning as his book. This morning we're going to look at the grief of the Israelites and two different perspectives on that grief. We're going to see two different people looking at the suffering of Israel. And in that comparison and contrast, I think we're going to learn quite a bit. And in that process as well, we're going to see Moses at one of the greatest points of failure in his life. Somebody who held such promise is going to suffer a tremendous disappointment. And you know that happens a lot in this world, where we see things that promise great excitement and disappoint. Think of, everybody got the President William Henry Harrison as their favorite U.S. president, right? Not many of us. He was really popular when he was elected, and then he got pneumonia and died 30 days after he went into office. So that was a letdown. How about Star Wars Episode 1? Right? Some people are still recovering from Jar Jar Binks. Michael Jordan's comeback from retirement on the Washington Wizards. Legendary for not being legendary. Whatever piece of technology you just replaced because it was the piece of technology that was supposed to solve all of the problems that your previous piece of technology had. And now you've realized that your current one also has problems. Failure, disappointment, things that hold great promise and then don't actually come through. It's a common part of life. And this morning we're going to look, as I said, at a pretty colossal failure for one who should have been a hero, and the kind of failure that should have also been the end of the book of Exodus. It should have been a very short book. But we're going to see that there is another being at work behind the scenes who specializes in cleaning up failures. And I think that'll be a very hopeful thing for us. And so as we launch into Exodus chapter 2, we're going to pick up in verse 11. We're going to see a little phrase here in the New American Standard. It says, "Now it came about." And this little phrase has shown up a couple times in our text already. It showed up in Exodus chapter 1, verse 5, when it said, "Now it came about that the descendants of Jacob," setting up the story. It showed up again in Exodus 1:21 when God blessed the midwives. "Now it came about that God gave the midwives families, a household, in response to their courageous defiance of Pharaoh." Last week, it showed up again in chapter 2, verse 10, when Moses was brought into the household of Pharaoh, and it came about that Moses became the daughter of Pharaoh's son. And this week it's going to show up twice again. It's sort of a marker that we're changing a significant perspective, that we have something new to pay attention to. And so we begin looking at the failure of Moses this morning, the failure of Moses in verses 11 through 13. And we're going to find A boy all grown up and filled with misguided fervor. So look with me at Exodus chapter 2, verses 11 to 13 as we begin. It says this, "Now it came about in those days when Moses had grown up that he went out to his brethren and looked on their hard labors, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way and that, and when he saw there was no one around, he struck down the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. He went out the next day, and behold, two Hebrews were fighting with each other. And he said to the offender, 'Why are you striking your companion?'" So as we pick up into this section here, we see Moses is no longer an infant in a basket. He is grown up. He has grown up. And it's been an impressive and exclusive upbringing that he has enjoyed. It's sort of glossed over quickly here in the text, but it's helpful to appreciate what it is that Moses has been privileged to. We will continue to take advantage, as we did last week, of Stephen's inspired message on this text. In Acts chapter 7, as you recall, Stephen, one of those who was appointed by the early church to be an early deacon, a man mighty in the word, he gets arrested and brought before the high priest, and they're chewing him out, and he says, "Time out. Do you guys have any picture about what God's been doing through our people since the beginning? You're missing everything. You think it's all about you. But the leaders of our country have always been losers. God's always been the hero." And he preaches this magnificent sermon on the failures of Israel throughout history and how God redeems every single one of them, right up to the biggest failure of Israel of all in murdering the Messiah, who then turns that around into salvation. And in the middle of that sermon, he tells quite a bit about Moses, because Moses was the great hero up alongside King David of the people of Israel. And he gives us a little insight into Moses' upbringing when he says in Acts chapter 7, verse 22, "Moses was educated in all the learning of the Egyptians, and he was a man of power in words and in deeds." So the childhood of Moses was spent in extensive learning, and a really rich tradition it was to be educated by the Egyptians. They were pioneers in science, mathematics, astronomy, and medicine. If you visit Egypt today, you don't get that impression. They're not on the cutting edge, as generally speaking, of a lot of these disciplines. But you have to remember, the civilization in which Moses is living is very different than the civilization that lives in that part of the world today. And these were pioneers in their day. The great pyramids had already been built. The Egyptians were already exploring practical mathematics, and many scholars also believe even theoretical mathematics. The later great mathematicians that you may have heard of, like Pythagoras, many of them studied in Egypt before they came back and had their big breakthroughs. They were extensive watchers of the sky, great knowledge of the patterns of the stars and their correlation with the seasons and annual phenomena. We've found medical textbooks dating back almost exactly to the time of Moses, dealing with treatments for all manner of things, including cancer, depression, heart disease. This was the land that invented the papyrus scroll and inks and dyes and made great strides in writing and record keeping and art. All of these disciplines were poured into the mind of young Moses. And he was very adept at his studies. And that is why Stephen said he was a man of power in words and in deeds. And that might be triggering a thought in your mind, wait a minute, I thought Moses couldn't talk real good. We'll get to that. But as a young man, coming off of his education in Egypt, he was very accomplished. He was a man who was strong, capable, intelligent, and as our culture would say, ridiculously privileged. He was a man who seemed to have it all. But he was also a man with a great internal struggle over his identity. It's hard in our culture to relate to issues of privilege and identity. You know, we just don't talk about those things anymore. Actually, that's all we talk about anymore. These aren't new issues. These aren't new struggles. Moses has this riptide in his heart of being pulled to the Egyptian culture that he has excelled in, but finding as he gets older, his heart belongs to his ethnic people. And we don't know to what extent Moses interacted with his fellow Israelites as he was growing up. But this sense of connection with them develops to the point where Moses decides, I need to go out and visit and be reacquainted with my people. And so in Exodus we read that Moses, now grown up, decides to go out to his, and it is key that he uses this term multiple times in this part of the text, brethren. He's identifying with them in a close familial way. And Acts tells us this is around the time that Moses was 40 years old. So, apparently the original goal was simply to visit these Israelites and connect with them as brethren, but things aren't going to quite work out that way. There comes a point in every person's life where they really do kind of need to choose an identity by which they will be known. We talk a lot in our cultural moment about the spectrum of identity and how fluid it is and how changing it is. But in reality, we almost always inevitably choose sides in life, choose what is going to come to define us in life. And Moses is coming to that point in his life. He's at this crisis of identity, and he's moving rapidly from any sense of Egyptian identity to a distinctly Hebrew identity, and that's a good thing. Moses is returning to identify with the people of God instead of the people with all the visual power. It was also politically risky as a slave-born child who had been raised in Egypt to go back and re-identify with the slave population, especially after Egypt's experience with the Hyksos. But Moses says it's worth it. I want to find out what's going on out there among my people. And as we're going to see, his trip proved to be quite eye-opening. As he goes to visit his people, he sees them subjected to hard labors. And I'm sure this wasn't conceptually a surprise to Moses. Having been raised in Egypt, I'm sure he was well aware that the people of Israel were doing hard work. He had no doubt visited many of the places they had built. He had no doubt been blessed by the prophet of their efforts. And so he knew, likely in broad strokes, the roles of his people in that country and had seen what their exploitation had led to. But it's a very different thing to know about oppression than to see it firsthand. There's a very different experience when you actually are confronted relationally with people who are in the midst of oppression. And so I want to just pause here for a moment, because there's a couple of lessons I think we can draw out already. First of which is just looking at Moses and that shift in his life from identifying with the Egyptians to the Hebrews. Whatever our background is, have you made that shift in your own life where when you come into church and you look around and you see these people from different backgrounds as well, that this is your brethren, this is your family, this is your identity, you're drawn to the people of God. Another thing I think that can perhaps be a challenge to us is it is worthwhile to involve ourselves in the oppression and the suffering around us, to not ignore the context in which God has placed us. You know, it's good to hear reports from our global outreach partners around the world in places like China and India and hear about what's going on in countries like that. It's good to listen to updates from the Union Gospel Mission in our own backyard, to keep up with the headlines in the news about local poverty and sex trafficking and the meth and prescription drug abuse situations and all of that that's going on. It's good to keep up to date with those things by way of report. But it's even better to seize opportunities to see it for ourselves and consider how we may be used of God in the middle of those challenging circumstances. We can't all tackle everything, but to have a willingness to say, I'm willing to engage with real oppression where it shows up, I think is an honorable thing. Moses, no doubt, is provoked and outraged and grieved by what he has seen. He is full of ethnic zeal. And what is more, he has in him this growing desire to be a deliverer. And all of that training and that power and that influence and position and prestige that he enjoys, Moses sees, I'm in a perfect position to be a mighty deliverer for my oppressed people. And in that tumble of emotions and aspirations, he sees what was probably a common occurrence, an Egyptian beating a Hebrew. But it is one that will radically change the course of Moses' life forever. You might even say this encounter is providential. Moses makes the mistake of entering into this situation all on his own strength. As I said, Moses sees an Egyptian beating a Hebrew. Moses says this is one of his brethren being beaten, again reinforcing his identification with this man. And all of those disconnected feelings and desires now lock in an instant onto a single point. And we read here that Moses looks both ways before he acts. And we aren't exactly sure why, but likely one of two reasons. One is Moses may have been looking for an Egyptian authority to step in to report this offense to. We see in Acts 7:24 that Moses wanted to defend this Hebrew man. And so it could have been Moses was like, is there anybody that's going to do something about this? That's possible. It's also perhaps more likely that Moses was checking to make sure that the intervention he was about to take was not going to be seen by any Egyptians, that he would be able to keep it a secret. Because the moment Moses takes this Hebrew slave's side, he is putting himself in great political danger. Hatshepsut has, at this point, stepped back from political power. Most likely, her umbrella of protection that may have been sheltering this Hebrew in the court of Egypt is gone. And a new pharaoh has come to power who hated Hatshepsut. If you go throughout Egypt, you'll find most of the places where her murals and her statues, etc., were defaced, her face chiseled off, as this new pharaoh tried to erase the memory of her influence from the land. And so the new power structure doesn't like the whole regime under which Moses was protected. So taking this step would have been very risky for Moses, and it's likely he wanted to make sure that nobody else was going to be a witness to what would happen. But in either case, Moses steps in, and he ends up physically intervening, delivering a blow to the Egyptian that proves fatal. And it's not clear from the text that that was what he meant to do. The same word for striking the Egyptian here is the exact same word that it used of the Egyptian striking the Hebrew slave, and later of the two Hebrew slaves fighting amongst themselves. It's the same word. Two of them weren't fatal. So we don't know that Moses went in with the intent to kill, but he obviously did go in with a lack of self-control. Moses, in particular, makes one of the classic sins that we are all tempted to make when we see actual injustice but respond in our own strength. And Acts makes it clear when it says that when Moses went in, he didn't just want to defend the Hebrew. It says he wanted to take vengeance for the oppressed. Moses wasn't just trying to end the suffering of the Hebrew. He was trying to take vengeance and make the Egyptian suffer for what he had done. And that's a very different thing entirely. And it could be that that desire for vengeance is what whipped Moses into such a frenzy and made him strike so hard. Moses has allowed his fervor over real sin to lead him into his own personal sin. If Moses had the authority to take this Egyptian's life, as some have speculated, then he had the authority to command him to stop beating the slave. And if he didn't have that authority, then it was wrong for him to take it upon himself. Defending the innocent is an important godly virtue, but vengeance is always to be left up to God. Deuteronomy 32:35, Romans 12:19, Hebrews 10:30, it's throughout Old and New Testaments. Vengeance is not our domain. Sadly, Moses chose to take this divine prerogative upon himself, and he ends up murdering a man and hides the evidence. in the sands of Egypt and hoped there would be no Egyptian witnesses and that this grateful Hebrew he had just saved would keep it their little secret. And apparently he's rather satisfied with himself, because the text says it was the very next day he goes out for his next foray to visit his brethren. He's not at home going, what have I done? What have I done? He's like, well, yesterday went well. Let's go connect some more today. And off he goes. And this time, providentially, God confronts him with almost the exact same scenario. Except it's not to an Egyptian to a Hebrew now, it's two Hebrews. What is Moses going to do about a Hebrew striking a fellow Hebrew the exact same way and with the exact same word as the Egyptian striking a Hebrew? Well, this time he tries to talk it out. A sense of love and connection causes him to take a more peaceful route than he had when motivated by a sense of social justice zeal. And so he simply asks, why are you striking your companion? Makes you wonder what would have happened if he had asked the Egyptian, why are you striking that Hebrew slave? Interestingly enough, these are the last words that Moses will speak and the last thing that Moses will do in Egypt as a proud and confident man. But before we see Moses' undoing, a few brief lessons again from this, I think for us, first is we need fewer social justice warriors and more biblical justice defenders. There is, perhaps not explicit, but too often implicit in the concept of a social justice warrior, the desire for vengeance. And even if it's not an intentional one, too often that creeps in. And we've seen good causes lead to great harm and wrong because of people that were washing their zeal with vengeance. It is right to be provoked by wrong. It is wrong to right those wrongs outside of God's instructions. And that can be hard because God's way can be slower from the initial appearance of things. It may be God's will that the suffering doesn't come to an abrupt and immediate stop. And there are times when we have to trust to God and be patient in doing what is right, which is not to say ignoring or excusing or in any way tolerating evil or sin, or to be disengaged and simply wait for it to get better. But it does mean whether you're in a difficult marriage or a difficult society, that we have to often find ourselves in a position of enduring and doing it God's way slowly. We also see here the lesson that God's gifts, specifically in Moses' case, his gifts to Moses of intelligence and accomplishment and of a strong desire to be a deliverer, when they're combined with the pride of man, become curses. It was not Moses moving in the opposite direction of his gifts that got him into trouble. It was Moses moving in the direction of his gifts, but directed and steered by his pride that caused his problem. And we see this so often in our lives. It's almost axiomatically true that your greatest strength is your greatest weakness. And every time we come to do what we feel we're good at, independent of God, we open ourselves up to great danger. I think of the example in our own country of John Brown. Came up on our Tuesday morning study. John Brown, you may be more familiar with the events that unfolded at Harper's Ferry in 1859. John Brown was an abolitionist who was sick and tired of the scourge of slavery. And so he plotted to take over an armory and arm the slaves so that they could shoot their way to freedom. It was the right moral issue to take up. It was the wrong way to accomplish it. God had not given John Brown the right. And sadly, it got him and all of his followers slaughtered and set the abolitionist movement back. Contrast that with the efforts of William Wilberforce in England, who worked just as hard, just as passionately, and far longer, but with lasting success by the grace of God. For Moses, however, the die is now cast, and now he is about to reap the consequences of taking matters into his own hands. And so we go from Moses, the failure because of his misguided fervor. Now we see Moses gripped by crippling fear in verses 14 and 15, that fear that has been so prevalent through our story so far. Look with me at verses 14 and 15 where we read, "But he said, 'Who made you?'" This is the Hebrew that Moses is confronting. "'Who made you a prince or a judge over us? Are you intending to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?' Then Moses was afraid and said, 'Surely the matter has become known.' When Pharaoh heard of this matter, he tried to kill Moses. But Moses fled from the presence of Pharaoh and settled in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well." So in contrast to what Moses was expecting, he is rebuffed by this Hebrew. He no doubt thought, oppressor, oppressed, me. I speak up for the oppressed. That makes us two on the one side against the oppressor. Right? That's how this works. That's how being Batman works. Moses is, you know, Bruce Wayne by day in the palace of Egypt. Batman out among his people, striking down Egyptians and saving his brethren. But instead, the two Hebrews combine together to face him, stop fighting with each other, and the oppressor says, "Who put you in charge of us?" They side with each other against Moses. He is the outsider. And the big reveal. Oh, and are you, and as it literally means in the Hebrew, are you in your heart right now pondering whether you're going to murder me? Like you did that Egyptian? The secret's out. The man Moses spared went and told everybody. And the gossip is spreading fast. Moses panics and says, "Surely the matter has become known." And this is the result of Moses, the great deliverer, acting in his own strength. He has blundered into murder, and now his actions are known. What hope he had of being a protection and a help to his people through his position in Egypt, he realizes is now gone. And he must now flee the wrath of a Pharaoh who has no pity on the adopted son of slaves, especially one that will murder the Pharaoh's citizens on their behalf. But also mark that word known, where Moses says, "Surely the matter has become known." We're going to see that word again right at the end of our text. And it's going to be in beautiful poetic symmetry to what we're reading now. Word finally reaches Pharaoh. He pronounces a death sentence. When it says he tried to kill Moses, that's an idiomatic way of saying he announced that Moses is now under the penalty of death. It wasn't that Pharaoh was literally chasing Moses with a spear down the halls, but that you are now in mortal danger if you remain here. Moses hears the sentence, and he is able to flee to Egypt, or flee Egypt to the east, and settle in the land of Midian, escaping the actual carrying out of his sentence. It is a barren wasteland that he wanders into, of nomadic tribes, and he finds an oasis in the middle of nowhere, and sits down. Here's a map of the area in which our events take place. There we go. Yeah, on your left, you will see Egypt. In the middle is the Sinai Peninsula. And then over to the right of that in Saudi Arabia is the area where most of the Midianites lived, although they also sometimes came over into the Sinai Peninsula. But it's to the east and away from Egypt. And if you remember when we looked at the big map of Egypt, if you get more than about a mile away from the Nile, you're in the middle of nowhere. Here's a really old photo of the land of Midian. This is the more interesting landscape of Midian. A modern-day image of the same region looks like this. It's nowhere. So it wasn't like Moses was walking down Main Street and he's like, oh, that well looks nice. He was in the middle of utter desolation and happens to find one of the very few oases that could support life. And he sits down. The mighty Moses, the zealous defender of social injustice, the outcast fugitive, the lonely vagabond in the desert. This is not the story arc Moses had pictured for himself at all. Surely he had hoped to have been embraced by his people, to have been a force working for their freedom, and now he was sidelined. He's gone from fervor to fear, and now we're going to see to flight. A couple quick lessons as we look at the flight of Moses. Pride blinds us into thinking that people will have a higher estimation of us than they do. Is that not true? Pride orients us to the feelings of others in general. Because pride is often a comparative thing. Also, when we have trusted in our own strength, the presence of someone stronger than we are, or an intimidating circumstance that seems stronger than we are, fills us with terror. If you live by your own strength, you still know somewhere deep down inside that that is limited. And when you are faced by something stronger than you are, you run. And Moses ran. He is sidelined in his flight, and we see that in verses 16 through 22. Which says this, now the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came to draw water and fill the troughs to water their father's flocks. Then the shepherds came and drove them away. But Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. When they came to Reuel, their father, he said, why have you come back so soon today? So they said, an Egyptian delivered us from the hand of the shepherds, and what is more, he even drew the water for us and watered the flock. He said to his daughters, where is he then? Why is it that you have left the man behind? Invite him to have something to eat. Moses was willing to dwell with the man, and he gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses. Then she gave birth to a son, and he named him Gershom, for he said, I have been a sojourner in a foreign land. So alone and adrift in Midian, Moses runs into a providence of God and recapitulates one of the most famous love stories in the Old Testament in the process. So first, we find out that there is a priest of Midian with seven daughters. Bless his heart. Who are these Midianites, and who do they worship? Well, the Midianites were not like the other tribes in the land of Canaan or like the Egyptians. In fact, the Midianites are actually kind of distant relatives of Moses. Back in Genesis 25, 1 through 2, we read, Abraham took another wife whose name was Keturah. She bore him Zimram and Jokshan and Medan and Midian and Ishbak and Shua. And there's a bunch of options for you young parents to choose from in that verse. The Midianites, though, were descendants of Abraham. And within Midian, there was actually retained the worship of Yahweh. In the Far East, the Midianites became almost entirely given over eventually to the worship of Baal or Baal. But on the western side, the side that Moses would have run into, it was quite likely that he ran into those who still worshiped the true God. And we will see that this priest of Midian later is going to offer a sacrifice to the true God later in this very book. And so I think there's good reason to believe that God actually led Moses straight to a shepherd priest who would provide the spiritual fathering Moses would need. And this is pretty neat because Moses had an adopted mom, but this is a man who's never had a father figure in his life. His only experience with a father figure is a Pharaoh who's trying to kill him. And God is now going to bring him to a gentle, wise shepherd priest and just leave him there for 40 years. I think that's very intentional. I think that is perhaps one of the underemphasized or underappreciated blessings of God in the life of Moses, and probably one of the things that ends up shaping Moses the most. What a blessing. But Moses figures out to gain a father, he has to start with a wife. The seven daughters of this Midianite priest came providentially to the very well where Moses was rethinking his life. And they draw out water into troughs, as it says, for their sheep to drink. And that would have been a long and tedious process, bucket by bucket, filling these little troughs where the sheep could then all gather and drink. And just as the job is done, here come the boys, the male shepherds with their flocks, and they chase the seven women away to take advantage of free water for their sheep. Another injustice. Moses once again steps in to help. But this time we do not read of any violence. In fact, it is a significant thing that in this case it specifically says Moses stepped in to help them. He's not seeing himself just as the deliverer. He's not seeking vengeance. Moses is now going to use his masculinity to help, just to help. And already we can see there's some growth in his character. The daughters hurry home early after receiving this help and are received by their father, Reuel, if you want to get your Hebrew on. He is called by multiple names in the Old Testament, and there are entire articles dedicated to why, if you're really curious. But the name he is most commonly referred to in our account of Exodus is Jethro. So if that name rings more of a bell, that's the same guy we're talking about here. So Reuel, or Jethro, comments on how early they have arrived home. You guys are all home early? Which may be an indication that this was like every day, how every day worked. My daughters go, they draw the water for the sheep, the boys chase them off, steal all the water, leave, they draw the water for the sheep again, and then are able to give their sheep water to drink and go home. Because the daughters had already finished drawing water, right? So you would think that they would have been home on time. So it looks like they may be getting picked on the regular. But Jethro here notices and says, you're home early. And the daughters say, you won't believe what just happened. An Egyptian helped us out. Like, Egyptians don't help out Midianites. That's not how they roll. Whether it was from Moses' accent, from perhaps his clothing, it could have even been face paint, it could have been the tonsure, the way that Egyptians traditionally cut their hair, something about Moses' appearance after having just fled from Egypt, they didn't realize that he was Semitic, that he was a Hebrew. They just figured he was an Egyptian. And what must it have been like for Moses to write down these words as well? Because notice as well that the daughters say something that Moses has been wanting to hear for a long time. They tell their father, we were delivered. Moses finally stops trying to deliver and just tries to help. And the account taken back of this event is, we were delivered. He finally succeeds. And what it must have been like for Moses writing this down. And they said, I delivered them. That must have been pretty special. Reuel knows a good future son-in-law prospect when he hears of one. So he jumps into Middle Eastern hospitality mode. Well then, where is he? You didn't forget to invite him to dinner, did you? Right? So he's going on the rampage there. Okay, grab the dishes, get the lamb, and one of you go tell that Egyptian to get on over here. And Moses comes and dines with him and decides to stay forever. Is really how it's laid out in our text. They come to an agreement where Moses says, I am willing. And that word willing isn't like reluctant. Okay, fine. It's the idea of being pleased. He says, this is a good place for me. I'm willing to stay here. And in turn, he is given his daughter, Tzipporah, if you again are really into your Hebrew pronunciations, in marriage. The marriage produces a son named Gershom. Hebrew names are fun to say, by the way, which is a name that literally means cast out. But it is another cool wordplay here in this name because it literally means cast out, but it's also almost exactly the same sound as a compound word of the words stranger and there. So it's like this name means I was cast out and a stranger over there, all wrapped into one word. And I kind of wonder if the level of wordplay in this name is somewhat indicative of the fact that Moses was a man mighty in word and in power, indeed. But Moses is settled in for the long haul. He is happy to have married into this Midianite family. He will take up the family business of shepherding, and he will spend 40 years out in the wilderness under the assumption that whatever God may have been trying to do with him in Egypt is now just a memory of a blown opportunity. And that this is what will be the rest of his story. And this is also where the narrative pauses and just leaves Moses hanging. And so let us pause here too briefly for a few quick lessons. First of all, the sideline isn't necessarily the end of the line. Just because you have come into a scene in life where you've been placed aside of what your dreams and hopes and desires, of where all the action seem to be, it does not mean that God is done. Similarly, it can take a long time for God to prepare us for his purposes. And that can be even longer if we spend that time fighting against his wilderness work, trying to get back into the center of the action. Or sometimes that time may be shorter if we're willing to cooperate and learn the lessons God is trying to teach us with where he has placed us. Failure is often used by God as preparation. It produces humility, and it strips our virtues of their attendant excesses. And so when we crash and burn, acknowledge sin, repent of sin, but don't lose heart. Allow that to be used as much in the hands of God to mold you and to shape you as a season of blessing. If you feel sidelined today, don't give up. That may be exactly where God wants you. I think of the example of carpentry, where you have this tree that grows up alive and vibrant and full of sap and energy. And what's a carpenter do? He cuts it down. And then what's he do? Just lets it sit for a long time to season, to dry, to become stable. Because if he fashions it too soon, it'll warp or crack or twist, and it'll deform the final object he's going for. And so God often has to do this with us. And we may have come from a season of rapid growth and excitement. And God may say, I have a great and mighty thing to do with you, and that is why I'm going to cut you down and set you aside and let you season. And we must be patient for the timing of God. There's one other possible lesson in here. I don't want to lean on it too heavily. But that is that we know from Numbers chapter 12, verse 1, that Moses marries a Cushite. Cush is one of the descendants we read about in the Old Testament who becomes the father of the Ethiopians. And if you've seen pictures of Ethiopians, you will know they don't look like Israelites. Deep, dark, ebony black. And there's some question as to whether this is a second wife that Moses marries later or whether Zipporah was Cushite. The Midianites had some intermarrying with Ethiopians because they both worked along the same trade route. And it's possible that Zipporah, in fact, I think it is even likely, given the history of Jewish tradition and interpreting this passage, we even have a 2nd century BC play about the life of Moses that makes a big deal about Zipporah being black. I think it's likely that Moses, either with Zipporah or almost certainly with a second wife, marries a black woman. And this is a great hero of Israel. And I think this is kind of the sort of thing God likes to do when he's running into a group of people that tend to be ethnocentric and stuck up. Is he'll take your hero and arrange an interracial marriage. Deal with it. Which is great. Again, you can't read too much into that, but I do think it is just worth pausing and noting that interracial marriage is not a bad thing. I don't think that's a big struggle in our church, but it's good to note it when we encounter it anyway. Cross-cultural marriage is tricky. It's true. And I'm in one. My wife grew up in Japan, not America, and that has led to very different perspectives on things. But even though cross-cultural marriage can be a challenge, That's different than interracial marriage. An interracial marriage needs to never be an obstacle to what God is doing in the hearts of his children, nor an obstacle to us accepting and celebrating what God is doing in the hearts of his children. So let's pull up for a brief moment here, because Moses here is living this quiet rural life out in the sand, but God's not done with either him or his people, and our text gives us a little tease that big things are about to happen. And so I want to end with a teaser for next week, the faithfulness of God, verses 23 to 25. Now it came about in the course of those many days that the king of Egypt died, and the sons of Israel sighed because of the bondage, and they cried out, and their cry for help because of their bondage rose up to God. So God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God saw the sons of Israel, and God took notice of them. So God explodes back in the narrative in a big way here. As always, when God acts, he does so perfectly, and in this case, in stark contrast to how Moses had acted. We see God waited to act until the right time. That same phrase we saw at the beginning, the now it came to pass, this is the second time it occurs in our passage. So now it came to pass that Moses went out and blew it and ended up in the desert. Now it comes to pass that God steps up to the plate. It's his turn to bat. And we're going to see that go so very differently. About 40 more years have passed at this point. Pharaoh, that had decreed the death of Moses, is now dead himself. And the situation for Israel is otherwise relatively unchanged. They're still in bondage and still in suffering. But what has changed for the Israelites is that now, 40 years later, they're finally willing to talk to God about it. And they cry out to him for help. This is what is new. It has taken generations, but the nation is finally lifting up a prayerful lament to God. God's work in the lives of his people is so often predicated on their prayers, and this should not surprise us. We are told so often to pray without ceasing and persistently, and that we do not have because we do not ask, and yet it is so easy for us to skip this vital part of a Christian's life. So are there areas in your life right now that you are in distress? And you haven't cried out to God about it. Here's a pro tip for you and for me. Don't wait 40 years. God was not only waiting for Moses to be prepared and humbled, he was also waiting for his people Israel to be prepared and humbled. And God knew when the right moment had come, and he knew the right reasons to respond as well. God hears the groaning of Israel and remembers his covenant with them. God's ears are always open to hear his people, even when our prayers are from such a place of confusion that the only thing that can get communicated is the Holy Spirit interceding for us with groanings too deep for words, as it says in the New Testament. But he hears always, and he always responds exactly as he has promised to respond. And in the case of Israel, when they called out for help, God responds according to the promises he has made them. The covenant promises made to Abraham and renewed generationally to Isaac and to Jacob. And that phrase, God remembered his covenant, is not implying that God had forgotten his covenant. And when they started whining, he's like, oh yeah, I forgot, sorry. It's a Hebrew idiom that means God is about to apply the covenant. So whenever you see God remembered his covenant throughout the Old Testament, that means God is about to apply the terms of that covenant. And so for almost 500 years, there has been anticipation of what God is going to do. And for the original readers, when they saw that phrase, and God remembered his covenant, they were scooting to the edge of their chairs. Oh, man, it's going to happen now. And we can have that same hope when we cry out to God. We never have to fear that God will act for the wrong reasons or motives. We can always trust that God will act consistent with his character, particularly as expressed in his promises. When we cry out to God, dear Christian, we can take advantage of knowing that in Christ he will never leave us or forsake us in our trials, that he will provide a way of escape to every temptation, that he will give us wisdom from above freely, that he will cause all things to work together for our good, that he will guard our hearts and minds against anxiety, that he will comfort us as a sympathetic high priest, that he will perfect the work he has begun in us, that he will raise us to glory. And this is just a taste of the promises God has made to us that He will remember and apply to us if we will cry out to Him. So do we do that? Because our God never changes and His heart is always in the right place. The last sentence in our text brings it home and sets up for us one of the most iconic Bible stories in the whole Bible that we're going to study next week. God saw the people of Israel, and it says God knew them. Remember how Moses was terrified and said, everything I did has become known. And that was sort of the end of Moses' time in Egypt. That exact same word now shows up when it says God looked at His people and knew them. Moses failed and feared that everyone had known about his failure, and they did. But God, patient until the right moment, acting for the right reasons and with a loving heart, is not worried about what others know. Instead, He is bending near to His people to know their troubles. Suffering Christian, God knows intimately and instantly, and He cares, and He will deal with you faithfully and graciously according to His promises. Because the kind of God we serve is a God who is kind. So cry out to Him and put yourself in the center of where He can bless you. And if you don't know even where to start, talk to someone. Take advantage of our bridge ministry. If you're a sidelined Christian this morning, don't let your past failures prevent you from hoping in a God who redeems those failures for His own purposes. Learn from your sin, learn from your foolishness, and then be ready when God unveils the next part of His plan for you. Even if you have to wait like Moses until you're 80 years old, it will be worth it. Don't believe me? Come back next week. Let's pray.